following is a presentation of Crane's Chicago Business, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Radio.
I'm Amy Guth, and this is Crane's Daily Gist. Today, a look at a lawsuit centering around office tenant labor rules and a check-in with Crane's Chicago Business residential real estate reporter Dennis Rodkin to see what's new in the local market this week. Your top stories today: Illinois has one more big step on its long journey toward legalizing marijuana use. After a last round of tinkering, the wide-ranging law passed the Senate last night after a 38-17 vote. The bill now moves to the House. The more than 600-page bill tackles a number of issues, including provisions to expunge past arrests and convictions and ways to help impoverished and minority communities recover from some of the effects of the war on drugs and get a shot at profiting from the legal marijuana business. The bill, which had languished for weeks, was called for a vote in the Senate only after sponsored made changes that opponents had sought. It limited a home grow provision, which had been opposed by law enforcement, to medical use. Lawmakers also added language to address concerns around how police will ultimately deal with cannabis in enforcing DUI laws. Also, China, the world's largest soybean buyer, has put purchases of American suppliers on hold after the trade war between Washington and Beijing escalated, according to sources familiar with the matter. State grain buyers haven't received any further orders to continue with the so-called goodwill buying and don't expect that to happen, given the lack of agreement in trade negotiations. President Trump escalated his war with China earlier this month, ramping up tariffs on about $200 billion of Chinese goods, prompting Beijing to retaliate with further tariffs of its own. Negotiations with China are expected to resume at the end of June for the G20 summit, when some analysts predict a potential resolution. More on both of these stories and others at chicagobusiness.com. Coming up, a conversation with Crane's Chicago Business residential real estate reporter Dennis Rodkin to see what's new in the local real estate market this week. That conversation and more after this word from our sponsor. A Chicago-based institution, Wintrust Commercial Banking, provides area businesses with local decision-making and a personalized focus. With specialty services for specific industries and tools like treasury management, commercial lending, and wealth services, the dedicated team will support you and your business through every need. Wintrust Commercial Banking was built here in Chicago to serve Chicago businesses. Learn more about how they can help you achieve your business goals at Wintrust.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. We're joined now by Crane's Chicago Business residential real estate reporter Dennis Rodkin to talk about what's new in the local market this week. Dennis, I want to start by talking about this story you wrote a little bit earlier this week about this very unbelievably gorgeous house in Hinsdale. It looks like a work of art, and yet it is another in your ongoing series of, I'm sorry, that sold for what?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it is. It's a stunner. It's designed by a premier Swedish architect. The owners were Swedish immigrants, or they came here to work at McDonald's headquarters from running a network of McDonald's in Sweden. So they brought their taste for this man's architecture. They had him come over. He built this phenomenal building that looks like something you would see in a movie, like on a bluff in California overlooking the ocean. One of the great things about it is it has these big glassy wings, two big wings that surround a long lap pool, and both wings open up by accordion doors so that it's all sort of indoor, outdoor, really a phenomenal house.
There's pictures of this house at chicagobusiness.com. It's really gorgeous. I mean, pool, that makes me want summer to happen.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
This is a house built for summer. It's not really built for Chicago winters, but it's gorgeous.
Well, but in the winter, it also would be a really interesting look because you'd have, you know, the snow falling on your plaza. And while we're talking about the pool on one side, there's also a pond, a large pond on the other side that several homes share. So in the winter, you'd be looking sort of down your slope at this frozen pond. It's quite a place.
I mean, I could think of worse things to do in the winter, gazing out at the...
Exactly. And then we get to the price.
Yeah. And that's where it gets so weird.
Yeah. So it sold for not much more than what they paid for the land before they built the house. They built the house, bought the land and built the house in the early 2000s. They've had it on the, or had it on the market for several years, starting it up in the $10 million range. And they sold it for only about $2.5 million, which is not much more. I think it was $70,000 more than they paid for the land. And so, you know, I mean, houses often go for the cost of the land. I'm the littlest house on the block, and everybody has built big ones all around me. My house is very likely to go for the cost of the land. This one, you can't say that about. It not only is spectacular, but it's large. I think one of the problems for it is that it's in Hinsdale, where many of the houses, especially on that street, are colonials and European-inspired sort of old-time houses. But you would still think that somebody who has the money for a $2 million or previously a $4, $5, $6 million house where this price was would want Hinsdale and a contemporary, but they had a very hard time selling it. It was on the market for many years.
Which is mind-boggling. Again, head to chicagobusiness.com and look at this picture, because it's hard to imagine that any scenario in which, okay, I'm going to buy the land and get this monstrosity, this beautiful stunner of a house for free, essentially.
Essentially for free, yeah. And unfortunately, that is what's happening. I mean, this is a pronounced example, but that's happening all over. I build something that is very personal to me, very much my style, and perhaps that's not what buyers are looking for.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and just by virtue of the fact that your social media feature of talking about how many of yeah. these houses go for so much less and such shocking numbers that even people that are not deeply, you know, ensconced in the real estate world and know a ton about real estate, even just kind of casual observers on Twitter, I notice, are always going, wait, what?
Yeah.
And responding to, and it's shocking that it continues.
It also, you know what's strange, Amy, is it's kind of become a game that I feel like I created a game and other people play it, because now people are tweeting at me, hey, look at this one. I found one that either has sold for less than an old price or is going to sell because its asking price is so low. I get one of those probably 3 or 4 times a week now where people say, ooh, I found one, which is also a little bit distressing to think that this has become a parlor game.
That's right.
How bad will the price be on this suburban home?
But useful to have, you know, so many people, eyes and ears for you.
Sure. To have scouts out there helping me demonstrate that this market is struggling.
That's right. In other, as we're looking at other residential real estate stories this week, it seems like there's a lot of very beautiful, I mean, as usual, it's like gorgeous houses with some bad news attached to it, like yeah. it didn't really sell or this investment didn't really pay off, things like that. But we're looking across, you know, just glancing at the website even today, there's really beautiful homes on there that are, it seems like so much like, I'm out, I'm just out. So many people seem to be cashing out right now.
Well, yeah, you know, there are two stories that sort of bookend one another. We just talked about this very contemporary home, glass, really airy, spacious sort of a place in Hinsdale that struggled to sell. And at the opposite end of the spectrum is a mansion that looks like a castle. It's got crenellations like a castle in Oak Park, where a couple bought it in the early 2000s, renovated the daylights out of it. They re-tuck-pointed the entire exterior, which had to be a massive job.
Huge.
Redid a lot of the inside. It has these wood-beamed ceilings and murals and built-ins. They even built, I mean, they went so far as to, when they built a 3-car garage, they had it match the 1905 architecture of the house, which, again, has these crenellations and things. And when they sold it after several years, last week, they sold it also for not much more than they had paid. They didn't speak to me, but their real estate agent confirmed that they did not make back their total investment, the combination of what they paid for it and what they paid to rehab. And so somebody didn't buy that very contemporary one at a mm-hmm. high price. Somebody didn't buy this old rehabbed one at a high price. What's going to happen?
Yeah. And that it keeps continuing is
yeah.
so bizarre.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's way beyond the range of the normal economic cycle. It seems like it's continued much longer.
Well, it has, and I think I've said to you before, my counterparts in other cities simply are not reported. This is not happening mm-hmm. in other cities. We have a big droop going on. We, on Tuesday, when the Case-Shiller Index came out, we were once again near the bottom. We had the lowest price growth in April, which would be the most, I'm sorry, in March, which would be the most recent month the Case-Shiller Index covers. We had the lowest price growth since mid-2015. We're down to prices in March were up 1.8% from a year earlier. It's been up in the threes for most of the year, that sort of thing. And what's interesting there is the only cities that had smaller improvements than we had were 4 West Coast cities that a year ago, 2 of them were having double-digit price increases. They were in the 11 and 13% range. The other were in the 8 and 9% range. Those are Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego marching down the coast. And their prices have stopped growing because they were growing so fast. They were just going nuts. And there were all sorts of affordability problems, news stories about nobody can buy a house in Seattle. We didn't do that. We just kept marching along at our very slow or suppressed sort of a rate, and now we're marching even more slowly.
And so why is that?
Well, all the things that we've discussed. Population loss. Mm-hmm. We know that Illinois has lost population for 4 years in a row. Property taxes are going up. And in many cases, real estate agents have told me that one of the reasons people don't buy is we don't know where our property taxes are going. So I don't know how much more that's going to add to my house payment. There's also this question of whether I'll get the money back. When I buy the house, things are droopy in Illinois. We don't know what the financial condition is going to be down the line. We certainly hope that the new administration in Springfield can fix it. But if they don't, will this investment I made in this house sag even further?
Yeah. And then on top of that, just the last time we talked, we were talking about changing attitudes around homeownership with first-time buyers. I got to think that contributes to that too.
I think it does. And that's part of the story I did that we called the suburbs real estate problem, where I looked at what's going on, especially in sort of outer ring suburbs, places out along what was once called the Northwest Tollway. In the 1990s, there were nearly 200,000 jobs created in the first half of the 1990s out there on the Northwest Tollway. Now it's called the Jane Addams Tollway, but they're not seeing that kind of growth. So if I built my house following that kind of growth, I see all these jobs coming and there are more on the way. And Sears has, at the time, moved out from the city with 5,000 employees to an office park that supposedly is going to grow to 20,000 employees with many companies, not just Sears. But now Prairie Stone, that office park, has only 7,000 employees. Then the demand I saw coming my way for my big house I built in South Barrington, all those places out in that direction, that demand didn't really keep coming.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I'm endlessly fascinated by like the ebb and flow of residential real estate, because as we've also said, it so quickly jumps to other issues, social issues, economic ones, very human, emotional ones. It's fascinating to me.
Well, and it might turn. I mean, one of the things that interested me in that story about the outer suburbs is that one man, he wasn't in the far out suburbs. He was in Burr Ridge. He said, you know, when I built my big house in Burr Ridge, nobody had any idea the next generation was going to want to live in the West Loop. He said, now the West Loop is booming. We didn't see that coming.
Sure.
And of course, in the 1990s, very few people would have said, oh yeah, everybody in 2015 to 2020 will be wanting to buy in the West Loop.
Who could have known? If only we had a crystal ball, we could predict what's next.
Exactly.
Make our fortunes. That's what we could do. Well, thanks as ever for joining us to break it all down. We will talk to you next week.
Thanks, Amy.
Continuing today's top headlines, for months, traders debated which crops U.S. farmers would sow this year. That discussion is now turning to how many acres may be left unplanted as rainfall sweeps the Midwest. A Bloomberg survey of 10 traders and analysts indicated growers could file insurance claims for about 6 million corn acres they haven't been able to sow, almost double the record in 2013. Corn futures surged more than 20% to a three-year high over the past few weeks on fears that farmers wouldn't be able to get seeds into the ground ahead of crop insurance deadlines. So-called prevented plant claims reached 3.6 million acres in 2013, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Farm Service Agency. Field conditions deteriorated over the past few weeks, indicating significant corn acreage loss was a risk, according to Grow Intelligence, a New York-based analysis firm that uses satellites, among other data sources. Areas with the biggest risk of acreage loss were in central Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio, and the region around the borders of South Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, and Nebraska. Such insurance claims are considered a last-ditch effort for farmers who can receive only about half the value of their crop. Analysts in the Bloomberg survey cautioned estimates could still be skewed by the weather and the government's market facilitation program, a $16 billion aid package to mitigate the impact of trade wars. More on this story at chicagobusiness.com. Tempus, the genomic testing and data analytics company founded by Eric Lefkofsky, has raised another $200 million. The cancer-fighting tech company will use the cash to expand its work into treatment of diabetes and depression. The latest fundraising values the company at more than $3 billion, making it one of Chicago's most richly valued startups. Since it was founded a little more than 3 years ago, the Chicago-based tech company has hired nearly 700 employees and raised more than $500 million. Its most recent funding included new investors Franklin Templeton and Novo Holdings, a Danish life sciences fund. Coming up, a look at a local lawsuit centering around office tenant labor rules. That's right after this word from our sponsor. Wintrust Commercial Banking offers a full suite of financial resources designed to meet the needs of middle market businesses and larger companies, with comprehensive and personalized financial solutions coupled with bankers who get to know your industry's demands. Wintrust Commercial Banking is committed to providing the tools to help your business reach its strategic growth initiatives. You've got a vision for your business, and Wintrust Commercial Banking is here to help you see it through. Find out more at wintrust.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. This week, a federal judge denied real estate services company Jones Lang LaSalle's motion to dismiss a lawsuit alleging it illegally blocks companies from using non-union labor for improvement projects at the Chicago office buildings it manages. The complaint, filed in August by shared office provider Wacker Drive Executive Suites, called out Chicago-based JLL for conspiring with local labor unions to prevent hundreds of Chicago tenants from hiring non-union contractors for jobs like move-ins or office construction and maintenance. Instead, the complaint alleges those tenants are forced to hire union workers who command higher wages, a system Wacker Drive Executive Suites argues is a violation of federal labor law. JLL asked the U.S. District Court to throw out the case on the grounds that Wacker Drive Executive Suites lacked legal standing, and JLL has no agreement with unions to block non-union workers. Among other arguments, JLL also contended that any union-only rules it enforces are at the behest of the building's landlord. But a judge issued an opinion this week allowing the lawsuit to proceed, explaining the allegations show that JLL played a role in bringing about the increased labor and moving costs by separately agreeing to the union-only rule and enforcing it with tenants. The lawsuit, which seeks class action status for all tenants and subtenants at JLL-managed buildings in Chicago, spotlights what industry experts say is a long-standing common practice locally, illustrating the strength of union labor in the market. Many office landlords and managers strictly uphold unwritten rules that non-union labor can't perform work at their properties for fear of union workers walking off the job or picketing to publicly shame them. I'm Amy Guth, and until next week, that's all for Crane's Daily Gist. Thanks so much to producer Haima Black. Find analysis, breaking business news, data, and lots more at chicagobusiness.com. And find me on Twitter as @AmyGuth, and let's continue the conversation. For now, we'll see you next week.